Knock, knock. Radio. Radio not. Here's the sermon. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I've never started a sermon with a knock, knock joke, and I'm fairly certain I never will again. But I had to this week. I was on my way to Rutland to serve as guest preacher at the UU congregation last October when I heard the Hillary Hahn interview Silas read on NPR's Weekend Morning Edition show. I could hear the joyful memory of unexpected discovery in Ms. Hahn's voice as she mused about public versus private practice. And I was enchanted, and I felt called to deeper reflection about what she was saying on the radio. Voices over the radio can do that to you sometimes. But I also needed to think about the upcoming Rutland worship service. So I pulled over in Pittsford, and I scribbled down enough notes for future reference for me to find that interview again, and then I went on my way to Rutland. These tantalizing lost moments for reflection come back to me in mysterious ways. When I get the time and desire to look again, I can usually find my way back to the feeling of being located at a door that I want to open. In this case, the feeling I had on that drive to Rutland that Hillary Hahn had put her finger on something profound came back as soon as I read the interview transcript last week. I wasn't sure how, but I knew it tied into my theme this morning. Now, whether it tied into my theme in a way that will make any sense at all to you is another matter. You will let me know during coffee hour. And don't worry, if some of you come up to me and show me the free thinker space in your order of service with, say, 15 Roman numerals, and you say, I was keeping count of the number of times you lost me. Well, I'm just going to say that talking about God in a UU sanctuary is never easy. But you already know from Chris and Connie's song that I will be a traditional Unitarian Universalist in advocating heresy, that wonderful Greek word meaning personal choice. The idea that this NPR interview reading connected to perseverance did not require a great leap of faith on my part. It's a common human experience that the recollection of a person, a place, a sound, a scent, taste, some combination of all of these pieces of our lives, that the combination of these can unexpectedly connect to something that's new at that moment in our minds and our hearts. So here's how it unfolded for me as I read a transcript of Ms. Hahn's interview, then listened to a recording, and then reconstructed it as a story. One moment, there's Ms. Hahn just going about practicing, something she has done many hours for most days for much of her life. Then she decides to make a video. On a whim, she puts it on Instagram. Now, I don't really know what that means. Instagram is a Facebook-owned application that's especially suited to photos and videos. I know that, but I've never used it. You might be saying to yourself, well, that's a smooth bit of self-promotion on Hahn's part. But I'm not sure that that's true. It could be risky for a performer to be so public about all the work and frustrations behind the mastery that gets displayed in concert. She didn't say in this interview, but I can't believe it did not occur to her, at least subconsciously, that she was taking a risk in doing this. Anyway, she posted. And she persisted. 100 days. The only conclusion we hear in the interview is that she was genuinely surprised about how many people clicked on the practices and how they responded. I think she must have felt great. I mean, we all do when we get surprised by how many people notice us and respond with praise, gratitude, or sharing their own experiences. That's one of the things that makes social media compelling for many people who post on it. If I had to summarize, I'd put it this way. Ms. Hahn learned something new and joyful about herself in the responses that piled up. She realized that she is part of a hidden community of all of those people who practice music. And it got me thinking about all the ways that community hides from us. There must be more ways that we belong to each other than we ever recognize. Now, we say we are a place here, this sanctuary, for everyone to seek their own vision of the sacred. And that's true enough. But we are so private in what we find here, for the most part, that we are largely hidden from each other as a community of spiritual seekers. What becomes visible here is the behavior that's fed by all that searching, all of the social action things that we do. We don't spend a lot of time sharing the spiritual side of what we found here. We are so spiritually private that we have to persevere in our explorations of hymns like Over My Head if we're going to continue using them in worship. Reinterpretation is one form of perseverance. For instance, don't say yes or no, but just try and hold on to this thought. Perhaps God is a good name for the hidden ways that we belong to each other through love. The sense of singing and music in the air, the idea of angels, the feeling of gladness, even the troubles. Imagine them as mental Instagrams telling us of a hidden community called God to which we are invisibly linked. Imagine a hidden community of all people who strive to practice love and who imagine various ways that there is some love with a capital L, to which we all belong. Now, wait a minute, some of you are thinking. I'm a secular humanist, or a Buddhist, or a pagan, or something else non-Christian. As I see it, God is not a good name for anything. Your imagination is creeping me out. Fair enough. This seems like the moment to mention the French mathematician and scientist Pierre-Simon Laplace, who was born in 1749. His accomplishments earned him the nickname the French Isaac Newton. Now, I knew, I have to confess, very little about him when I went looking this week for the origin of the phrase, "I have no need of that hypothesis," in answer to the question, "What about God?" Laplace was raised in a devoutly Catholic family, and they expected him, and he expected himself, to become a priest. But it turned out he was a math genius with a bent for subjects like astronomy. So by the time he got to university, it was clear he was not going to become a priest. He did not believe the universe had room for miracles, Catholic or otherwise. The quote I was searching for arises from a meeting in 1802 with his former student, Napoleon Bonaparte, who had become the most famous military leader of his era and then head of the French government. Laplace had sent Bonaparte a 5-volume treatise on the structure of the solar system and the galaxy. And when they next met, Napoleon reportedly asked Laplace why he found not a single mention of God in any of the books, to which Laplace made his oft-quoted assertion that he saw no need for God. For the record, it's not certain that this conversation ever occurred, although it's been widely quoted. And many people believe that if it did occur, Laplace was simply pointing out where his calculations for what made the heavens stable differed from that of his famous predecessor, Isaac Newton, who had needed occasional interjections of God to stabilize everything. But this saying lives on in modern culture without these caveats. "I have no need of that hypothesis" often comes up when a well-read atheist is not only declaring where they stand on the God question, but doing so smugly or combatively. "I have no need of that hypothesis." It has a whiff of branding believers as deluded or weak people. It's sometimes followed up with comments that turn those implications into blunt put-downs. In response to our Hibbs faith that there must be a God somewhere, they have a ready answer. "No, there's no credible evidence to say that, and there's a lot of reason to doubt it." What I've just said is a form of confession. I can hear myself as a teenager and a college student agreeing with such atheists. I grew up hearing this atheism in very negative language from my father. And of course, in those days, the only God I thought we were talking about was that traditional, all-powerful Christian creator God. But these days, I have no need of that hypothesis strikes me as an odd thing to say. It sells us so short. Since when are the only hypotheses we should embrace those testable by science that we are aware we need? Religion suggests, rightly I believe, that the better question is not what we need from the family of hypotheses about the divinity, but what we want. Part of our humanity is rooted in wanting a god, or gods, or any name for mystery or whatever in the universe makes us feel small and meaningless. The evidence for that desire is overwhelming. That's why there are so many religions. Who says there must be a god somewhere? Traditional religious folk do, and a lot of good and horrible things have been done in the name of their god. But UUs have always been free thinkers who say to ourselves, hey, I've got an imagination. There is something in the universe that wants me to use it to stay in right relationship with love. My life has reframed for me how I think about God in a way that echoes how Hilary Hahn reframed how she saw practice. The original truth that I am an atheist in traditional Christian terms is still there for me, just as is her need to put in time playing on herself, practicing. That remains. But I now see the community of believers in the divine as much larger and more diverse than I knew as a teenager, wrapped up in that traditional image of God. I embrace God's stories that show me what is best in me and you and the world in which we live. Sometimes those stories are right out of ancient texts like the Bible and other religious texts. More often, they're out of the news or on the radio or social media, like that story I shared with you last week of the extraordinarily creative friendship between the artist Jackie Sumel and Herman Wallace, the convict who spent more than 40 years in solitary confinement. Or the stories that I actually hear directly from you when we talk. I've learned not to need scientific proof of gods named in such stories. There's a better standard of proof. Does this image of God, this shared image of God, steer me towards becoming more compassionate? Does it energize me in the struggle for justice? Does it deepen my sense of beauty and wonder all around me in what the late Mary Oliver called our wild and precious lives? These are gods to stand by. The issue here is partly personal spiritual perseverance. In other contexts, you've heard me recite this poem by the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke. I think it applies also to this personal perseverance in our understanding of God. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete the last one, but I give myself to it. I circle around God, around that primordial tower I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? Hilary Hahn's observations about practicing violin are quite literally about perseverance in a very particular form. But they also say something to me about communal perseverance, collective perseverance in our spiritual lives. To be a Unitarian Universalist for me is to always be circling around a relationship with what might be named God in many religious traditions, and not remaining hidden in that circling. I hope we will feel safe enough with each other to be more public about our gods with each other. There will be joy and greater awareness of this hidden community. We will get into spaces over our heads where humans are meant to be. Let those of us with the need or the desire to do so fly spiritually wherever the Spirit takes us. And in a congregation like ours, we will always be blessed with resolute atheists who can lovingly serve as air traffic controllers whenever our visions of the divine look to be on collision courses. And that community of resolute atheists among us, should also always feel invited to come out of hiding. Blessed be. Amen.